From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Gorlot, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies, and welcome to Worldviews. Middle East expert Juan Cole says the Israeli-Palestinian conflict has been relegated to the back pages of American newspapers.
You know, I don't think most Americans even understand the situation. They think the Palestinians are mean and terrorists and they're doing something to the Israelis. They're only seeing one side of the story.
On today's show, we'll begin a two-part conversation with Cole about the modern Middle East. But first, Joshua Landis and I will discuss the latest developments in Syria.
It's really the death knell for Western efforts to carry out regime change in Syria. It's a win for Iran and Russia in the Middle East.
That's all coming up after news from NPR. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlot. Joshua Landis, thanks for joining me all the way from Vermont. But I have to get a Middle East update from you because there was some interesting news this week about the Trump administration ending the covert CIA program to arm and train Syrian rebels working against the Assad regime in Syria. So give us the scoop here on the secret program and why the Trump administration is ending it.
This official announcement of the end of arming rebels is really the death knell for Western efforts to carry out regime change in Syria. It's a win for Iran and Russia in the Middle East.
Well, it's a win, too, for Assad, isn't it? We were training rebels who were fighting Assad. Doesn't he also win out of this move?
Absolutely. You know, this is a long time coming. President Obama was not at all committed to the rebels. He really carried out this policy almost for domestic reasons, to quiet opposition and lobbying groups that wanted him to do something more dramatic in Syria. He was not at all convinced that this was a good policy, but he spent some money on it. And America spent billions of dollars funding this insurgency in Syria, which undoubtedly prolonged the civil war, but it never won. Russia jumped in 2015 when it looked like Assad might be struggling, if not failing. Iran, Russia, Hezbollah all escalated. Every time the United States, Saudi Arabia, the Gulf countries threw in more money, Turkey as well, threw in more money to rebels and helped them more, Assad's supporters escalated. It caused a lot more death and destruction in Syria ultimately, and it's turned out to be a failed policy.
Well, isn't it an interesting thing, though, that the Trump administration just bombed Syria not too long ago for the use of chemical weapons, and now we're no longer going to help those that are fighting against the regime there? And, I mean, what about the consequence of perhaps empowering the radicals there? You know, are these rebels really going to go away now? Are there going to be others that fill the gap? I mean, what are the longer-term consequences here?
Well, I think this is going to weaken the entire gamut of rebels. There are hundreds of rebel groups. But the radicals are the most dominant ones. And they have emerged over the last several years as the powerful movements. And we see that in ISIS as well, out in the east of Syria. But Al-Qaeda and its associates are very powerful in the west of Syria. The United States has lost interest ever since the radicalization started into the end of 2012. The world got spooked by these rebels. They kept on trying to fund moderates, but the trouble was the moderates were always weak, and the extremists were able to conquer them in many instances or put pressure on them and expropriate their weapons. So a lot of U.S.-supplied weapons and Western-supplied weapons were dribbling through and getting to the extremists. It was not a good program. The Syrian opposition was not united. You know, Assad is winning today. The likely outcome in the next year or two is that Assad is going to defeat a lot of these rebel enclaves that still exist today. The Kurds in the north of Syria that the United States is arming, equipping, and fighting alongside of will not be defeated by Assad anytime soon. They're going to be powerful. But all these smaller Arab Sunni groups, it's a big thump for them. And it's a big thump for many of the many bright Syrians who wanted a better Syria, who've gone into exile, who threw in their lot with the revolution. you know, this is Assad coming back to power. And it's a dark, dark day for many very talented Syrians who hope for a better Syria.
All right, Joshua, thank you so much for the update and, as always, for your insight.
Well, it's my pleasure.
We'd love to hear your thoughts about this discussion or answer any questions you might have. Leave your comments in the Worldview section of KGOU.org, or you can like us, follow us, and interact with us on Twitter. We're at WorldviewsKGOU, and I'm at Suzette Grelot. Next, I'll talk with Juan Cole about the historical factors that have shaped the modern Middle East. I'm Suzette Grelot, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Grelot, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Juan Cole is a professor of history at the University of Michigan and an expert on the Middle East. He also writes for the blog Informed Comment, where he shares his thoughts on Middle Eastern history and religion. Juan Cole, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you so much, Suzette.
Thanks for being here. Well, you have such a fascinating history in studying, growing up really in the Middle East, a long presence there, growing up, your family being posted there. So you've seen so much in that region in terms of its developments and the way in which it's grown and changed. You've studied everything from languages in the region to religions and histories and cultures of the region. So as a Middle East expert, and I, you know, as you might not be surprised, we spend a lot of time on this show talking about the Middle East. It's definitely a part of the world that we pay a lot of attention to for many reasons. But can you just start by kind of, you know, thinking back about your history there, kind of what are some of the main issues we really need to know? What are the highlights? What are the things that if you're just going to, you know, start with a blank slate, what are the things that we really need to know about the Middle East?
One of the characteristics of the Middle East that people, I think, generally have a sense of, but it's not usually foregrounded, is how fast the population has been growing for the last 150 years. A place like Egypt went from on the order of 5 million in 1850 to something near 90 million today. And that kind of demographic growth, that kind of population growth, has big implications for our understanding of the place. Are there jobs for all those new young people? And, you know, just since 1980, Egypt doubled in population. So that puts pressure on infrastructure. Is the government able to school them? If they can't get a job and the large numbers of them are underemployed or unemployed, what do they do with their spare time? And you have in the Middle East, gender segregation is pretty widespread. So you don't see boys and girls hanging out with one another a lot. If you have to postpone your marriage as a young man till you're 30 or 35, because you just don't have the money to get an apartment and move out, what does that do to your psychology, to the position of young women, and so forth? So that complex of issues around rapid population growth, which is not unique to the Middle East by any means. You have it in sub-Saharan Africa, India, some parts of Asia. Although, you know, in some parts of Asia, like Japan and China, they're actually now growing old. So they don't have that problem. So the Middle East is one of those areas of the world where burgeoning growth is a big thing.
There, I've seen some statistics that suggest that, you know, up to 75% of their population might be under the age of 30.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that's just tremendous to think about that huge youth bulge. And again, you know, as you mentioned, kind of the developmental consequences of that and making sure that they can be employed. What about education, too? I mean, is this also something that they struggle to support their population given the large numbers of youth?
Sure. It's a big problem. You have a country like Egypt, which is a relatively poor country, and the government education system is pretty ramshackle. You know, they have very large class sizes, which is not good for education. A lot of the teaching is rote learning, so the kids are not being taught how to analyze. You get people coming out of the Egyptian educational system who want to work for, say, an international company, and the company will complain, well, you know, we gave them this analysis to do, and they can't do it because they haven't been trained to do that. It's not that they're not bright. So it's the kids that went up through the foreign schools. You know, you have the German school or the American school, and you have an American university in Cairo. Those young people, often from fairly well-off families, they'll get a proper education. The people who go to the state schools and some provincial university might come out with a degree that's relatively useless.
So you know Joshua Landis, of course, good friend of yours, studies the region. He often reminds us how poor this region is. I mean, I think we're touching on this issue of significant poverty in the region. And so when you put all this together, you've got obviously economic challenges, social challenges, and you know, those themselves might actually contribute to a great deal of the conflict we see in the area, internal and inter-regional conflict. I mean, how would you understand, how would you help us understand conflict in the region from perhaps an internal perspective, and then maybe adding to that notion of, you know, a significant amount of intervention and regional dynamics and other players like the United States, like Russia, like others in Europe that have played a role in some of the conflict we've seen there?
Well, I think we have to break down conflict, because there's all kinds of conflict. There's crime. There's a revolution. They're not caused by the same things. The social science, and you know this literature better than I do, doesn't seem to show that poor people make revolutions. It's, you know, when you're hopeless, you don't try to change things politically as easily. You're hopeless. And maybe you don't also have a lot of resources to try to change things. You're just trying to make a living and keep the wolf from the door. So it appears to be that it's when people get a little bit better off that they're more likely to make that kind of trouble. And so like the Tunisian Revolution of 2010, 2011 was in one of the wealthier societies in Africa. And it was a demand for personal liberties and democracy and so forth from, you know, the Tunisian middle classes. And it had fair success. So that's one kind of trouble. And it's not being caused by poverty. I think, sure, you know, if you have, for other reasons, a guerrilla group operating, easier to find people to join it if you can pay them a little bit. If people are desperately poor, so it's kind of a labor pool for guerrilla action and what we might call terrorism out there. That would be a factor, but I don't think that most of the violent conflict in the Middle East is mainly about poverty. Poverty is a break on certain kinds of development which may feed into it. So, for instance, Adam Przeworski at the New York University crunched the numbers on societies that transitioned successfully from authoritarian governments to democracy. You know, I think the political scientists are very clever. They actually bracket why this might have happened, you know, why this process might have started. But then his question is, if it starts for any reason, if people seem to want to try to move towards democracy, do they succeed or not, and under what circumstances? So you had a one-party state in Taiwan from the end of World War II until the late 90s. And then the thing broke down into a two-party system. And, you know, it's not that there are no problems in Taiwan, but more or less that regular parliamentary elections are occurring and there are two parties and so forth. That's a relatively successful transition. So his question is, why was it successful in Taiwan and maybe not in some other places? Or it happened in Spain after Franco. And his conclusion was quite startling, is that there's one single data point that tells you whether how likely it is. It's not dictatorial. There are some exceptions. But on the whole and by and large, one single data point tells you how likely they are to succeed. It is how wealthy the society is. So if you looked at those revolts that broke out in 2011, the youth revolts in the Arab world, and you went down the list of the ones that had some success in moving towards a more open society, a more democratic system, is mainly Tunisia. It's the wealthiest of them on a per capita basis. You have to exclude Libya because although it looks on paper like it's wealthy because of the oil just goes to the government. So it's not, you know, it's not like ordinary people necessarily have a lot of money. So that when you ask about poverty and conflict, if poverty weakens society and weakens politics, so it's easier for dictators to establish themselves and rule, but then they're inflexible. You know, dictators don't have a feedback loop. You can't go back to them and say, you know, your policy is wrong because it's harming our children this way. They would just like put you in jail. So then that makes the politics brittle and then maybe sets things up for violence.
Of course, this is a longstanding debate among some political scientists regarding whether economic development comes first and political development then follows. That relationship between economic and political development is in some cases a bit muddy. But the point that, you know, you have a lack of wealth, I guess, in the region, which would explain, at least to some degree, the ability to transition from authoritarian rule to something more democratic, resembling a representation of the people. But I mean, can we really talk about this region without mentioning Israel and the Palestinian conflict and how that influences everything in the region? We recently had a visit by the ambassador from Afghanistan, for example, Afghan ambassador to the United States, who was asked about, you know, the region. And he said, well, we need to really solve that Palestinian situation. So, I mean, we hardly even bring it up anymore. We're talking about Syria. We're talking about all the other dynamics in the region. What about Israel and Palestine?
Well, I think actually the corporate media in the United States connive at not bringing it up. I think it's people who bring it up a lot are blackballed. I think the Americans simply do not understand how central this issue is. And some people argue that it's irrational and that it's a small issue and so forth. But people are irrational about politics. However you look upon the Mexican-American War, the fact is and maybe those guys at the Alamo weren't really all that heroic or admirable people. Some of them were slavers and so forth. But if you were in the late 1840s, the Alamo excited a lot of passions in Maine, you know, in places far away. Why? You know, it's identity politics to some extent. Well, you know, from that kind of old white American, you know, paradigm about the Alamo. That's how the Middle East feels about the Palestinians. They feel that they're Alamo. They're under siege, and they're an innocent people that they identify with, who are daily being having their land stolen from them, having their rights taken away from them, living in a state of statelessness. And one of our Supreme Court justices, I think, influenced by the theorist Hannah Arendt, said that being a citizen in a state is the right to have rights. So a stateless person like a Palestinian doesn't have even the right to have rights. And if you think about it, what's the first thing the Nazis did when they decided to get the Jews? They took away their citizenship. They left them stateless. They were no longer Germans. And then anything you wanted to do to them, you could do to them in the aftermath, because they no longer had the right to have rights. It wasn't just Jews, Gypsies, and there was a time when people's citizenship was taken away from them in the millions, very lightly. Franco took away the leftist citizenship in Spain. The Soviets took away the white Russian citizenship. I mean, in the interwar period, there were millions of people who were left stateless, and often to whom very bad things happened as a result. One of the things that post-World War II order did under the United Nations was to make it a scandal to deprive people of their citizenship. And so the UN, I think, estimates on the order of 12 million stateless in the world. There's 7.4 billion people. That's not very many. But, you know, a very large proportion of those are Palestinians. And so if you attend to the West Bank press, every day there's a shooting, there's a stabbing, there's an occupation of a building, there are people moving in, there are people being moved out, wells are going dry because the other people dug their well deeper. People are being, you know, olive trees are being cut down. People are being deprived of their basic economic and human rights. And it is Israelis who are depriving the Palestinians of these rights, not the other way around. The Israelis are militarily occupying the Palestinians. I don't think most Americans even understand the situation. They think the Palestinians are mean and terrorists and they're doing something to the Israelis. They're only seeing one side of the story. There is a legitimate Israeli narrative, but I mean, frankly, the Israelis have no leg to stand on with regard to the occupation of the West Bank. This has been going on since 67. It's not a military occupation anymore. There's not any war of which it's a part. And international law doesn't allow you to flood your population into occupied territories or to alter the life ways and disadvantage the people who live there. It's supposed to be a temporary thing during a war, and then you give it back. And the Israelis are not giving it back. So you're talking about a situation where several million people are being left stateless, and there are these daily inequities, and that's front page news everywhere, not just in the Arab world, in the Muslim world. And it's not front page news in the United States. It's not news at all. We'll get on page 17 if at all, but probably it's not even being reported.
You've been listening to my conversation with Juan Cole. He is a history professor at the University of Michigan, and he writes for his blog, Informed Comment. You can find the blog at juancole.com. Next week, I'll continue my conversation with Cole. We'll talk about media coverage and the role oil and religion play in creating conflict.
I think a lot of it is in our heads. It's the way we have decided to put the Middle East under the sign of religion. You could understand why that might be to some extent, although I think we go wild with it.
Worldviews is produced in partnership between KGOU and the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Katie Holland prepares our research. Jacob McClellan edited this interview and produced this show. For Joshua Landis, I'm Suzette Rolott.